Hi, Caroline. Thank you so much for inviting us here today and for sitting down with us.
You're welcome.
Yeah, we've obviously met before. I know you've been in the private aviation space for some time. You've kind of now taken us behind the curtain a little bit, which I and the team are very excited about. What I think is the best place to start is your journey's obviously been an interesting one. How did you get into the space? What did that journey look like? Can you give us a little bit of detail there?
Sure. So I'm Caroline.
Yes.
I'm currently the managing director of LunaJets Dubai.
Yes.
We are one of the leading private jet charter brokers. But the way I got here, wow, is through my sisters, actually.
Okay.
So one of them was moved here about 18 years ago, and she was working for one of the other private jet charter brokers here in the region. And she said, Caroline, you've sold houses, you've sold wine, come to Dubai,
yes,
Habibti, and sell some planes. And basically, wow, that's how I came. So I came over, started learning all the airplanes, the categories, and the way how to sell a private jet, because obviously you don't sell it the same way as you sell wine or real estate.
Okay.
And yeah, that I did that for around four and a half years. But then I got curious as to, I wanted to understand why private planes were so expensive, or what was the reasoning behind an owner allowing or not to do a private jet charter and to allow it. So I wanted to move to one of the operators and to understand how that went on the owner's side. And that's when I came to ExecuJet, which is actually part of where we are today as well.
Yeah.
And I did that for a few years. I was a key account manager with them. And I was directly the point of contact between the owners and the management company. So I was directly involved with the ultra high net worth, the actual owners, and obviously the whole band of the PAs and all of that.
So just quickly, when you say the owners, you mean the owners of the actual jet itself?
Yeah.
And then, so are you working on the owner's side there? So you're saying you're kind of putting fees together, or what is that?
It's kind of representing, owners are genuinely busy in their schedule.
Would you imagine so?
So they want to have one person of contact.
Yeah.
So I was kind of the person of contact between them and the management company, so that they could always call me and saying, listen, either I want to set up a flight, which they technically would still do through the pilots, but I would help them with changing the color of their airplane, or
that specific
arranging the maintenance of the aircraft, schedule the downtime.
Were you doing that in your private capacity or still through ExecuJet?
Yeah,
okay. So let's just go back quickly, because we can jump forward too quickly sometimes. So you say you were selling houses and wine, which both sound like nice things. So where were you at that stage when you're selling? So your sister's in Dubai then already?
So I finished studying. I graduated in Edinburgh.
Okay.
And then I traveled around a couple of years. And then I settled back down in the south of France.
Okay.
So the wine was one of a very famous French winery in the south of France. Not cheap to sell either. So that was bar high in terms of like quality of products. And then real estate I came into because my father-in-law had his house for sale.
Okay.
And the market was booming at that time, and it still is, in the south of France for northern Europeans to come and establish, buy a holiday house, basically, in the south of France. So it was all kind of always into the luxury segment. So wine was kind of more expensive ones of the brands.
I'm with you.
The real estate was the same. So they were holiday houses, but that came with a premium.
Yes.
And that was also in the south of France. And then, taxation
became
what it became.
And or is.
And here there is still none. So that was one of the triggers that really pulled me here.
Okay. So then you're in that private jet space. Did you have any foothold, any kind of logistical understanding of what it looked like before you stepped into the industry?
Not at all.
So you kind of, from what I gather from that brief story is that you're quite happy to dive into something you don't know and learn on the job, I suppose.
Yeah, and I mean, this is 15 years ago, right, that I started here. And
we
all knew that Dubai was starting to build up momentum. And a lot of people were still kind of afraid of coming here and not sure what it was really about. And I was like, well, listen, there's a beautiful aircraft out there. I've got nothing to lose. So we just took the leap with my back then boyfriend, now husband.
Yes.
And we came. And, you know, and it's... And it's just been nonstop ever since. And I don't regret it for a second. Because it's just, the region has grown so much, especially with the jets.
Yeah.
when I came here 15 years ago, we had around 300 aircraft in the region.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's doubled, if not tripled. I mean, there's now the skies have opened, the rules have changed. So it's a lot has, the dynamics have changed as well.
Okay.
And it's just, it's an amazing industry to be in here because everyone is now coming.
Yes.
And it, the whole infrastructure is here now. And I mean, look at us, there's so many airplanes
Incredible.
Around us.
Yeah,
it's, you know, and it's a pleasure working with those machines.
Okay. So let's, that gives us some context, which is helpful. So you then come to ExecuJet, you start saying, well, I want to see behind the curtain on the ownership side of it,
yep.
which I guess is the right way to do it, because then you're going kind of ground up, for lack of a better word.
Yeah.
And then, so you're working with the owners. Tell us about that. So you sort of, you're saying, what does that sort of entail? What is that, what are you doing? You're doing things like, you said, changing colors. Are you working with pilots? Are you working with crew? Are you working with, I mean, is
with,
it
with
all
encompassing? With all the departments, it, basically when an owner gives an aircraft to a management company, it's for them to manage it from A to Z. They just want to buy an airplane because they like it.
Are you transacting in the sale of the aircraft as well?
I was in the second stage.
Okay.
Yeah. So initially I was purely managing the relationship and understanding what it really entails to manage an owner, the expectations, their budgets, to do the, you know, the forecasts, how much it's going to cost, where are you going to travel to. And then, afterwards, when you become more comfortable, you can then go into the transaction side, which I did as well.
So explain something to me, because I'm wanting to learn. So I think a lot of people understand, I don't think they understand the business of private aviation. They might understand the glamorous side of it from what they see. But, I mean, there's a logistical and a business side to it that you've learned to navigate.
Mm.
Now, my question is, what does it look? So an owner comes to your initial, to ExecuJet at that time, when you get in on the ground, and they're saying to you, okay, I have an aircraft already. I'd like to then lease that aircraft out for, I mean, what is it? Is that like a timeshare model? What does that look like?
There's different models. I think it's, before that, I think it's more about understanding what an owner really wants and what fits his, what he, because there's always a difference between what you want and what is actually
viable
and also a good to have that is going to complete the missions that they're looking for.
Sure.
So I had, back in the days, for instance, I had a client call us, good old-fashioned call that came into the company saying,
yeah,
I want to buy a Legacy 600,
yes,
which is a big aircraft. And I basically said, listen, let us meet and let me understand what it is that you need,
yes,
and then we can go. Meeting after meeting, we met him, and it turns out that he needed an aircraft to fly to Sweden from here, from Dubai. And now the Legacy 600 doesn't have the range.
The capability is not
there. Exactly.
Okay.
To do it. So I was like, listen, you can buy an aircraft, but the least of the things you want to do is buy an aircraft that doesn't get you to the destination that you will probably most frequently go to.
Yeah.
So he was like, oh, but I've been told. I'm like, listen, I can demonstrate it to you. So
yes.
We chartered airplanes, and we actually showed him that the Legacy doesn't make it.
Okay.
Non-stop, at least. So he ended up buying a Challenger 605, which he still has till date.
Wow.
Which actually allows him to go from Dubai to Sweden and to most
so
of the destinations.
So you suggested he pivots from one aircraft to another, which is good advice.
Mm.
Does that advice come with, well, we also, in the long run, going to save you money? Or is it just logistically it makes sense? Or both? Can you combine those two things?
Saving money in aviation just doesn't rhyme.
Yeah. I guess when I say saving money, I mean, long term. I mean, jumping from one aircraft to another. Oh, it's just
obviously, I mean, the Legacy was cheaper back then.
Yeah.
Prices fluctuate a lot in aviation as well, but back then the Legacy was cheaper. But we managed to buy an aircraft that had more range and that was slightly older for kind of the same budget. So
that's good advice.
You kind of compromised... And actually not so much at the end of the day either. I mean, these machines are built to fly for at least 20, 25 years.
Yeah.
And then you can retrofit them. You can, you know, can change the interiors.
It's, yeah.
There's a lot of things you can do with it. But I think the job of a management company is really to understand what the client is looking for and to find a crew that works well with that specific entourage, maybe for the business or for the family.
Yeah.
And then can really help him or her with, you know, the choice of the registration of an aircraft, where the base is, what kind of crew models is the, not models in terms of...
I hear you,
but the crew model in terms of how the, you know, they work on shifts, so they work month on, month off, 6 weeks on, 3 weeks off.
Yeah.
So it's, it's to understand what the client really is looking for, how many hours he's going to fly, how many crew he would need to do that, how much flexibility does he or she need in terms of giving you a lead time to set up a flight.
Yes.
So, and it's understanding all of that. And I think the aircraft management is really all-encompassing because...
So it's really not a one-size-fits-all either. I mean, there's so much nuance inside of that conversation.
Yeah. Mm.
Yeah.
And so it's really... And it goes from... How much does it, if I'm going to fly only 200 hours a year because I am a celebrity, let's say, and, I cannot go into a private terminal, in commercial terminal, sorry, because, it's a hazard for me and for the airport as well. Or it could be because I need to save time. I have meetings in Doha in the morning. In Muscat, I have another business, and I need to be in Kuwait for dinner.
Mm.
So it all looks at that. And then you have owners that just wants to have, because they can.
Yeah, well, so why not?
Exactly, and they fly 200 hours a year,
yeah.
And that's where we as a charter broker come in.
So that raises two questions. Number one, talking about the crew and the model, not models. Yeah. Well, what I wanted to understand was, does the crew work for the leasing company itself? Do you retain crew on your staff, or how does that work?
So management companies normally have the crew on their payroll most of the time.
In the same way a commercial airline would?
Okay. So basically the owner or the ownership structure, so it could be an offshore company or it could be whatever the setup that works better for them. So they will mandate the management company to run the business on the day-to-day show.
Mm.
And then what happens is that the management company really handles everything. They've hired the crew. They make sure that the aircraft is insured, that it's maintained.
Yeah.
They keep the records of the aircraft with them.
Okay.
They set up flight plans. They ask for overflight permits. They arrange for the fuel. They arrange for the catering. So they really manage the whole operation of the aircraft itself.
Okay.
And it's really...
That's nice.
It's super interesting to see because you really understand what goes into a cost of an aircraft, whether the fixed cost, because even to park an aircraft here, it's costing money.
Of course.
You need to insure it. It needs to go in or outside a hangar. And it's super interesting to understand the dynamics when you operate an aircraft privately or if you make it available commercially for charters.
Makes sense.
Because it's a whole different game as well.
And again, you come in, that's where you come in terms of those conversations and knowing what's viable and what's best for the owner. And So that crew, so just to focus on how often... I mean, I'm thinking how my mind works. If I was a private jet owner, which I'm not at the moment, but I'll have a look. If I enjoy the crew that I'm interacting with, how often would the same crew be attached to the same jet?
Well, it depends on how often you would fly, obviously. I mean, if you're going to fly every day, the likelihood of you having that crew every day is minimal. They have rest periods that they need to respect, and it falls under the regulations under which they operate.
Yeah.
So most of the crew can have a duty of like 12 hours, and then they need 12 hours rest. And then depending on how many times they do that, they would need consecutive days of rest and so on.
Okay.
So it's not super complex, but there is, you obviously want your crew to look fresh and
to be safe. It's a lot to think about when you really start getting into the nuts and bolts of it. And I suppose as a jet owner, you don't want to have to think about that.
No, of course not.
So that's where the management company is amazing. Okay.
So if you fly a lot, then you would have more than one set of crew. If you don't and you fly like 200 hours a year, which is not a lot,
it
may sound like a lot, but it's not, then you would have a captain, a first officer, and a cabin attendant, and you would see them all the time. And there are owners that I know even till date still have the same crew as they had 10 years ago.
Okay.
Because there is a relation of trust, there's a lot of that is discussed during a flight as well on board that has to stay private.
Yeah.
There's a whole element of privacy and it creates a circle of trust kind of thing.
Yeah, that makes sense. And then... We kind of got to the point where we were saying you're in Dubai, you're operating, so let's just move the story forward to the business here, what it looks like. So how many, 15 years is a long time in the seat.
Thanks.
And No. It would never say so. But my question is, how has the space evolved? It must have, Dubai's evolved enough. What does your space look like in terms of evolution?
Well, very simply said, this airport was being built when I came here.
Okay.
And I did the last air show in Dubai International Airport, and then they opened this one, and we did it in the smallest, the main terminal there.
Yeah.
And if you look around, these airplanes, there was not enough space to them to be welcomed, and there was not enough interest either for them to actually come here.
Sure.
if I remember well, 15 years ago, in the whole region, we had around 300 aircraft.
Okay.
And that was across Saudi and just like the greater GCC. And out of those, there was like 15 available for charters.
Wow.
So most of the aircraft back then were purely privately used because Emirates hadn't developed as much as they had. The mm-hmm. international, the connectivity within the region wasn't just there yet. Still isn't 100%, but that's great. Leave it there.
It's getting better. Yeah.
But basically, there's been this amazing vision of the country, of the UAE, to attract talent. And obviously, when you attract talent, you attract businesses.
Of
and
course.
Businesses attract more talent. And that attracts people that come here for different reasons, maybe
yeah.
for business reasons, maybe for private reasons, mm-hmm. taxation reasons, or whatever. So it has
grown.
Exactly, yeah. And it's grown into becoming this major hub. I mean, within a six-hour radius, you have access to 5 billion people in the world.
Insane.
It's crazy.
Yeah, when you put it in that context, yeah, it's a great point.
And you know, it's really, yes, it's hot in the summer, let's mm-hmm. face it. But, you know, the rest of the year, the whole infrastructure is amazing. And even in the summer, it's
yes.
amazing. And for the jets, even though it's a bit of a harsh environment still, it is still an amazing place to be for private jet owners.
Yeah.
They reach Europe within 6 to 7 hours. Mm-hmm. They reach Asia. And it's just super well connected. And the infrastructure that has been built, and look here, you know, this was non-existent. And it's been coming out of the ground. And every time that I come here, I see a new hangar popping up. Or a new billboard coming out, like, oh, this is going to be
here. It's the first time I've been here. It's phenomenal. Yeah.
And
I got you early and did a little bit of a walk around. And it's just, the scale is insane.
And it's only the beginning. I mean, if you look behind us, all of this will have hangars built around it in the next probably 10 years.
Madness. And the speed of build is also impressive, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So you've seen a dramatic change.
Huge.
That brings with it, it brings with it the clients, which I understand. It brings with us them basing themselves here, which I'm sure has increased. It must bring with it competition in your industry as well.
Yeah, a lot.
So how many, have you seen that evolve quite a bit too?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, back when I was in the aircraft management business, there were 5-6 major players that really were kind of holding the management of the aircraft in the region.
Mm-hmm.
Now there's been a huge influx of foreign companies that have come and are trying to get a share of the business. And there's nothing wrong with that, you know. I mean, Dubai has opened its skies to welcome foreign investors to come and base their aircraft here. And
of course.
And it's been part of the whole success of
everything. Yeah, it's the backbone, essentially, of what it looks like. Yeah,
but they've also been very open to allowing foreign aircraft to base themselves here. And I think that that's been pivotal in allowing more business to come in and allowing foreign aircraft to pick up passengers from here. Because that's a whole other nitty-gritty of the business.
Yes.
There's the rules of transportation of people.
Okay.
But yeah, there's a huge amount of aircraft now available for charters for us, which is great, but also for the private owners, there's just more and more aircraft that are being based here.
Okay. Okay, so maybe how do I frame this in a nice way? My question is, with that competition increase and with it going and evolving yearly, I would think, how does Lunajet's, I guess, time in the seat, again, not to focus on that too much, gives you the experience to understand what to do and what not to do. How do you set yourself apart in an industry that's growing?
I think experience is key in terms of understanding the region and how it has grown and also what can be done and what can't.
Yes.
So in terms of competition, in Dubai only, back then we had around 5-6 key major operators. Now, brokers have always been there. And operators would do brokerage because they had an owner, the airplane would break down, they needed a subcharter and all of that.
Makes sense.
They've always done it. Overall, and I made a list recently actually about this, is to understand what the current market lay is. And if you now take all the operators that are present in the market, you take all the brokers that are currently there, and I don't mean, you know, large brokerage companies. It's everyone who's doing brokerage.
You've looked at that data recently.
Yeah.
What
there
does it look like?
There is 73 companies
wow.
doing private
wow,
jet
wow,
charter
wow.
brokers. And that goes from operators, brokers. In the brokerage pure sphere only, there's around 35. So it's super competitive.
Yeah. Where 15 years ago it was what?
10?
Yeah, cheapest. Okay.
But basically what happens in those 35, and if I only focus on the brokers only, is that over the years, there's been people like me that have stayed here for a long time and that made a relationship with a specific owner, or one or two or three. And they get those charter inquiries from that specific family business or private individual. And they kind of survive on 3, 4, 5 deals a year. And that's kind of it. But Luna, we do 15,000 flights a year. So we have the experience, we have the volume. And it's, for us, it's more about the knowledge in the whole world. It's not just regional knowledge. We have offices in Europe, we have offices here. We're looking at expanding, obviously, as well. But it's the expertise and the avoidance of stupid questions. And I'm sorry for those that are out there, but
there's
just so many stupid questions that are being asked, or information that you should know before saying to a client, yes, you can do this flight. A lot of the brokers here don't understand what the regulations are. And they actually accept gray charters, which is a big risk in the industry.
Explain that gray charter.
So you have aircraft that are registered commercially, and you have aircraft that are registered privately. A commercial registered aircraft is allowed to charter, is allowed to rent out. A private aircraft is not. And there's insurances behind, there's trainings, there's a lot that goes behind. And I mean, it's another topic for another podcast. To answer your initial question, it really comes down to experience in what are you providing, who is going to be the best operator for your mission. And more so, because it's not a cheap business, it's also important to understand the pricing. And Luna, one thing that we do at LunaJet is that we have very small margins. So we work more on volume.
That's a transparent thing to say, which is great.
And it's known in the industry, you know, and I've seen it myself. People charge horrendous amounts of commission on the flights here. And we've come in for the past 2 years and we've kind of shaken it up. Where people are happy and they're like, gee, I used to pay so much. It's like, well, you used to pay a lot of commissions. And again, well done for the brokers.
Well, it's also smoking out. I guess you're making, by doing that, you're making everything more transparent. So you're making other brokers more accountable as well, based on that model.
And I mean, we share the names of the operators as well that they're flying with. So and there shouldn't be a secret. You know, if you have a good relationship with an operator, and there is a lot of operators out there. So it's, I mean, to give you some data, worldwide, you're like, I know you like data. So worldwide, there's around 24,000 aircraft, private jets, in the whole market.
It sounds a lot, but that just shows how niche it still is.
We're getting even more niche the more we get down. So 24,000 aircraft, give or take, in the whole private jet industry. Out of those, around 45% are purely privately owned. And most of those aircraft are based in the US. So we are actually left with a very small pool of charters available. And I think that that's what has also been pushing.
And that drives things, as it would.
So it's you know, it's a numbers game, actually. But it's a very niche market.
So Luna, for a combination of reasons, is able to still maintain its market share through good costing, through knowledge base, through the relationships that's that have existed for an extended period of time compared to competitors. So that's a good bit of insight, Caroline. And what we'll do is, I think for some behind-the-scenes stuff, we're going to take a walk around and we will look at, what do you call it? Not a demo jet? Okay.
So in Dubai, we have, we're quite fortunate. We have aircraft available because it's very difficult to get out there.
Yes.
And, you know, to get to get inside the airplane.
We've had to lean on you heavily to get anywhere near it.
So, and, you know, rightfully so, you know, it's quite a safe environment as well. And I wouldn't feel safe if I know that anyone could kind of walk on the ramp. So to do that, to counter that kind of thing, we also need simulators, right, for the for the pilots. So there is a facility not far away from here where we can you can rent an airplane, a mock-up of an aircraft. One is on hydraulics, the other one is static, so we'll sit on the static one. And what we use that for, and what they use it for, is training of cabin crew, because obviously you're working in a confined space, so they use it to help them with their skills of how to, you know, dress a table and set it up, and how to serve food, and how to contortion yourself.
Is that quite a unique thing to have in a space like this? Do other Or
in Europe, there's plenty of them.
Okay.
But
okay.
And in the US as well. But this is quite good because it gives you a real feel of an aircraft, and it allows the crew to train as to like the emergency doors where you have to like literally pull them out. And so it's a proper training facility center where there's big simulators.
Yes.
But they've also catered to the private jets, which is great.
Brilliant.
So yeah, we're gonna have a look in there.
Okay.
And see what it feels like to be in a jet, and then we can talk more about other topics.
Let's do it. Cheers. Okay. Hi, Caroline. Thanks again. And here we are behind the scenes. You said you would show us a little bit more and give us some insight. Where are we sitting?
We are sitting in a static mock-up of an aircraft, which is used for training. Mm-hmm. So we are Dynamic Advanced Training. They have two simulators with all the other commercial ones that they have around. But this one is used for static purposes, where the crew are trained with service excellence and how to improve on taking out tables and doing the proper service on board.
Okay.
And also because obviously it's a much smaller space. Uh-huh. They need to get used to how to navigate around customers and people that are sitting on board. And then there's another one, which is used for, it's on hydraulics.
Yes.
And you can actually recreate any kind of
equipment. Next door to us.
Exactly, yeah. Yep. And also here within the facility, so that they can use that for training, evacuation, opening the emergency doors, which here we don't have.
Right? Yeah.
Different, but an amazing spot to be in. And thank you to the Dynamic letting us in.
Amazing. Okay, so the closest I've been to a PJ before, so fascinating. You said the layout's slightly different to what you would expect.
Normally we have kind of four seats in the front, and then. And this is the typical heavy jet layout where you have two zones in the cabin, and then you would have one area in the front where we're sitting currently, and then you would have a table set up with four seats, and then either a credenza, which is the woods, or a sofa on the side as well. And then the bigger the jets, the bigger the cabin.
Amazing. So you said heavy jet.
Yep.
Meaning, explain that to me.
We categorize the jets. So we have super light jets, and then we go all the way to VIP airliners. So depending on the range that they have, the capacity of the people, it goes from 4 up to 19. And then above 19, we go into the VIP airliners.
Okay.
It goes from 4 to 19.
Yes.
And then in the 19 and above, we go into we have bigger aircraft, like the ACJs, the BBJs, that can cater to more than 19. And otherwise, you have aircraft that are laid out up to 100 people, all business class configured as well. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so heavy would be this?
Yes.
And heavy would generally take how many people, roughly?
It normally is certified to carry up to 10, 12, depending on the layout.
Just 2, 4, you said with the right, 7.
Could have 4 here, 4 in the club seating, and then 2 again facing each other. So you could have up to 10. But I never really recommend traveling with a full cabin capacity.
Okay, and then you said layout is, so no one can see behind us, but all behind the camera.
And go to the galley.
Galley, bathroom.
And then luggage access,
Okay.
But then you have bigger cabins where, like, there's now currently with the ultra long range aircraft, we have 5 cabins.
Yeah.
So 5 zones in the cabin. So you have a seating area, a rest area, a dining area, and then a bedroom.
Yes.
With a bathroom in the back kind of thing. And those are ultra long range aircraft.
Yes, which someone mentioned earlier that they've been in one.
Yeah.
Where there's a bedroom or bed in the back.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So is this a specific model though that it's modeled on, or is that just trying to feel?
If you look at the windows, it could make people think of a Gulfstream.
Yeah.
But
you said the spacing.
Yeah. It's more for the practicality of the training that we use this, and some influencers use it as well.
Okay.
To get some content.
Okay. So
you can rent it.
Yeah. That's,
okay. It's a very nice tool to be able to see the size of a heavy jet, and most of the aircraft that we have in this region are heavy jets. So it really gives them the look and feel of working in the galley environment where it's relatively small.
Yeah.
And then having kind of the area to work in as well, and the environment. Yeah.
Okay, that's some handy insight. So now we were chatting a bit after the first segment, and we were saying there's kind of different ways to enter private aviation in terms of timeshare, owning a jet, whatever that looks like. Can we get into that a bit just to give our viewers a bit of insight there?
So earlier we talked about ownership
of aircraft and management and all of that. There's three ways that you can, like, easy ways. There's obviously everyone will argue saying, no, there's more, there's less, but there's three ways. You can either have full ownership of an aircraft, you have fractional ownership, or you do charters where you just rent it.
Okay.
So,
but the full ownership, sorry to interrupt you. So the full ownership, if I'm a full owner, I could then have the option to lease that out to manage those costs throughout the lifespan of that ownership.
Absolutely.
Which a lot of people do.
Yes.
Okay. Anyway, I just wanted to
clarify. As a private owner, you can use it for private purposes and charter it.
Yeah.
Or you can use it for private purposes only.
How many private owners are leasing jets out or using it for charters?
Not enough. Okay.
Just because they don't need to, the appetite's not.
Yeah. If you remember earlier, we spoke about the 24,000 aircraft worldwide. There's around 9,000 aircraft worldwide that are available for charters.
Okay, so less than half.
What? Yeah. Okay. So most of the usage, it's still very much private usage of either the company or the individual that owns it or the government. But then out of those 9,000 that there is around worldwide, most of them, again, are in the US. And what they fall under is under the fractional ownership, which brings you to the second part.
Sure.
Where you can actually buy a fraction of an aircraft, and then you kind of buy into a pool of aircraft that are
which is the model that I've is but is that it's that almost like a timeshare model of a
fractional and timeshare is the same thing.
Same thing. Okay.
Yeah. So NetJets is very well known for that, for instance, in the US. Yeah. And it works well in the US because it's a very mature market with a lot of aircraft.
Which a lot of the golfers use, from what I remember. They involve NetJets in that time frame.
In the US should use them because in the US it's a very good structure. There's a lot of aircraft and but if you're gonna go into such of a program, I always recommend the clients that if you're gonna go and do this, fine, but make sure you're on the very frequently flown sectors.
Yes.
Because there's hidden costs between
bills of this. Can we get
they will charge you, I mean, this again, within the fractional ownership, there's you can buy hours and you can buy a fraction of the ownership itself. So then you kind of pool in.
But how do you manage that? So if I go into a fractional ownership or timeshare, or like you said, it's the same thing. So how do I know when I can or cannot use that share?
Well, that's the trick. So in the US, what they mainly do is there's up to 10 owners per aircraft. Okay. So you technically on paper own a share of that airplane.
Sure.
But you're also with that fraction, when you put it back into money, you will be entitled to use a certain number of hours.
Okay.
And then there will be peak periods like Super Bowl, New Year's and Christmas and holidays and whatever not. And at those times, there is a minimum notice that you need to give them to be able to fly on one of these.
Because overlapping is likely to happen if you're not. Right. Yeah.
When you own a jet, the likelihood of you wanting to use it for New Year's or Christmas is very high. So the fractional ownership comes with a bit of restrictions. But it works well in environments where there's a huge fleet because they can pull in and you kind of, you can use a heavy jet, you can use a light jet, you can use super long. And it kind of works in those kind of setups. When you buy a time, like there's programs where you buy 25, 50, 100, 200 hours.
Yeah.
They tend to be more expensive.
Okay.
Because you're buying convenience of kind of forecasting what you're going to pay.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, if you're going to pay a certain set fee for, let's say, 100 hours, you end up paying a premium for that. So let's say on the ultra long range aircraft, where normally me as a broker, we will be able to find an hourly rate of around 12,000.
Sure.
They would charge you 16, saying it's a fee transparent, but you're being charged more for an hourly rate. So again,
great advice.
And there is
good insights.
Hidden fees where there is peak fees, there is special handling fees. Some charge even more for Wi-Fi, some include the Wi-Fi.
How transparent do you have to be about the fee structure? Or is it a bit of the wild, wild west around that in terms of what you're actually billing for and the specifics around that?
So we bill per hour.
Okay.
We bill per hour on
the year. But inclusive of, I mean, there's a lot of
all inclusive.
Okay.
So there's a few exceptions that will apply if they kind of book now for next year.
Yeah.
We have a fuel surcharge that we put in there saying that if the fuel spikes out of control, then obviously that we have to pay. War risk insurance is never included unless we know it beforehand. And it always remains subject to permits and availability because airframes break down.
Goes without saying. Yeah. Okay.
So it's an all-in fee. And then obviously if they change the time, then there could be an extra fee because the owner himself might have to use the aircraft and it could impact him or the next charter. So normally we give an all-in fee and people are quite well educated these days. I mean, not only because of all the competitors, but also online information is readily available. So people can easily know what it's going to cost them on an hourly basis.
Yes.
And for that, you just have to be transparent. And that's where we are.
Again, your model is exactly that.
Yeah.
Okay. And in doing so, making others more transparent, which is forcing the market to adapt, which is amazing.
Mm.
Okay. So sorry, I actually interjected. You were saying, let's get back to the three structures in terms of how you do this.
Yeah.
If you want.
Of course. So you have ownership, full ownership.
Yeah.
Yeah, fractional ownership where you own a share of an aircraft and you own a share of the usage.
Yes.
Under the same kind of model, you can buy hours up front, which again, I don't really recommend because it's you end up paying more.
Yes.
And then you have the charter business only. So where you would reach out to a charter broker to get a one-off flight request.
Yes. Yeah?
And what you gain out of that is basically you have access to an entire fleet of aircraft worldwide. So you... And you have the expertise. And that's where you come as a broker, there will always be a backup option.
Yeah.
So if you're option one, you go, let's say, and it happens, you know, you go to the airport, you've booked your flight, the airplane goes AOG, which means aircraft on ground, it's broken. As a broker, we would jump in and have a substitute available for you. If you were going to go to a...
Solving headaches. Yeah.
That's what we're here for, is we would know who was going to be around for this specific flight, we can quickly jump around.
Such quick knowledge and is able to pivot that quickly. So really niche.
Yeah. So the charter, people often say it's more expensive. It's actually not, because our aim is to find the best aircraft available.
You wouldn't think intuitively that it would be more expensive based on the model.
Mm.
You would think booking in advance would be less costly than buying those hours up front. But it's... I'm saying intuitively, I know.
Yeah, so it's this from a CFO perspective, I understand why they want to have this visibility on, you know, you buy a certain amount of hours, you know what you're kind of getting.
Sure.
But it turns out that very often, if they're buying 100 hours, they actually pay for 100 hours, but they effectively use 70, 75.
Makes sense.
And because of all the extra charges that they're paying.
So how do you drive? Okay, let's stay on point. So I'm jumping around. So those are that you've gone through two of them. The third is outright ownership, I'm guessing. So
ownership, you can have full ownership and then you just call up a button and you go.
Yeah.
So it's very easy.
Technical question around, you said 24,000 available.
Mm-hmm.
You're saying 9,000 are in the charter pool.
Yeah.
Roughly.
Mm-hmm.
Do you try and encourage owners to put their jets in the pool? Or you just leave it out there and see what that looks like, because
obviously we have interest in having more aircraft available for charters.
Yeah.
See, we are, as a broker, we're kind of at the end of the chain where we have the users and we have the operators that manage the aircraft.
Yes.
So it's more of an operator that will try and put an aircraft on the charter market because it obviously gives them more work to do as well.
Yeah.
That we cannot necessarily influence an owner. If you see what I mean.
Yeah, it's a difficult conversation. I know what you mean, but I guess...
We have people that come to us asking, could you help us? Because we fly so much to find an aircraft. And then the transaction part of the business kicks in where we can sell and advise.
Here's a question. So I've seen this forms of this conversation, but maybe you can help me contextualize it and understand how this... Because there's a certain point in your journey as a private jet owner or someone that charters flights, where you're flying a certain amount of hours and then it makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
What is that?
As a rule of thumb, I always say 400.
400 hours a year?
Yeah.
Okay.
Some people will say less. In this region, I say if you fly 400 hours or more, get your own jet. Under that, it kind of doesn't really cut it.
Okay.
And, some people buy an aircraft from 200 hours onwards.
Yes.
Again, it depends on the size of the aircraft and it's all, you know, open for discussion. But for me in this region, rule of thumb around the 400 hours, then it does start make sense to have your own airplane.
Okay, that makes sense.
But still, please charter it out.
yeah, of course. So you say chartering out, you encourage that because obviously it increases your pool.
Of course.
As Luna. So,
yeah.
But now, I'm learning a lot here. So basically 9,000 roughly are out there for charter. Explain to me, so competitors, Luna, everyone's kind of trying to live in that same pool of 9,000.
Yeah, right, yeah.
That must create, I'm trying to think how that works.
There is a lot of competition.
Yeah.
And I think you have key players in key markets.
It's such an incredible insight because it makes you realize how small that pool in actual fact is.
Yes.
With 70-odd operators, as you said earlier.
There's more than that.
In Dubai, I'm saying.
Yeah, in Dubai, we have around 30 operators that are frequently around. Let's put it that way. But we don't only get requests for Dubai, we get inquiries worldwide.
Yeah.
And I think what is important as a broker is your network.
Yeah.
Because there are certain platforms that as brokers we all use.
Sure.
Platforms where we can find, where is our sourcing platform kind of thing.
Sure.
But the biggest advantage that we have is that we have off-market aircraft, as we refer them to, where operators are not on those platforms and they're actually ready to give access to us, LunaJet, directly to their back-end system where we can see where their aircraft are. So we have a full-on access to where they are.
If an owner puts a plane out for charter, does that mean that he obviously chooses which broker or which agency to use and list that with, right? As you would with in real estate, out of interest. What I'm trying to say is, so I've got a private jet, I've got a PJ, I want to put it out for charter. Do I go to Luna and another one and two, three others and try and see how much I can do? Or do I just go with one?
So normally, as an owner, you would go to a management company.
Yes.
And the management company would then kind of open the doors to the platforms of a brokerage.
Okay.
So we are very heavily dependent on the operators convincing the owners to put the aircraft available for charter. So the owner won't...
So those are relationships again.
Yeah. So the owners won't necessarily come to us and say, hey, well, I mean, they do as well, but we are asset free.
Yes.
We want to keep it
that way.
Because it gives us this impartiality on the whole market where we can say, go with that operator, go with that one. This is a better deal for you on this flight. Next time you might fly on this.
Yeah.
So we have relations with all the operators worldwide. And basically our biggest aim is to have off-market aircraft that are not on the platforms as well.
So you said, and remind me of the number, around 1,500 on your books. How many aircraft do you have?
So we have access to around 9,000 worldwide.
No, but I'm saying do you have access to all those 9,000, just yourselves?
Yes.
Wow, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so how many new PJs are coming on charter at any one point? Not many.
No, I think, I don't even know, to be honest.
Okay, okay, but the pool is increasing while you're trying to encourage it to increase.
It's hard to answer that question simply because aircraft come and go and they are made available for certain times and then the owner flies it for a year and then he wants to keep it or he puts it available for 3 months. If you look,
it's so fluid, it's hard to...
registered airplane that technically are available.
Yeah.
It's around 40-45% of the market.
Okay.
Overall. But to say how many are coming in or out, it kind of always stays within that boom.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, percentage. But that off-market... I guess when I hear off-market, it reminds me of real estate, but there's an off-market element to this as well, which is valuable, and that's giving clients or potential clients access to that. But now you're not just in the chartering space, you do many things. Can you give us just a high level of what the many things you do and what that looks like?
So Luna Aviation Group, as a group, we have four verticals. The first one is Luna Jets, which does the private jet brokerage.
Yes.
Then we have Luna Solutions, where we do aircraft transactions. So we have clients that fly with us, let's say 400 hours and more, and say, hey, listen, I would like to buy. So Luna Solutions caters to that, where we can advise on buying and selling aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
Then we have a division called Luna Group Charter. Right. Which is any charter above 19 passengers, we call it a group charter. So we can charter private jets that have been modified with like 100 seats, business config, or even the commercial airliners that we can then charter for larger groups like football teams and whatever not. So that's under Luna Group Charter. And then we have a fourth division, which is Luna Logistics, which is all the cargo business, basically. So cargo, onboard courier service, you name it.
There's a lot more under the hood than we realize. Okay. That's amazing, Carol. I think we're going to sit with another team member shortly, but that's incredibly insightful. And again, thank you for giving me a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity.
You're most welcome. Pleasure, Alan.
Thank you.